Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. RKD is a leading international design and architecture practice with 113 years of heritage, redefining architecture through design-led solutions that balance scale with intimacy and precision with purpose. From transforming the Guinness storehouse into the world's number one tourist attraction to designing LinkedIn's first purpose-built European headquarters, RKD delivers projects that are technically robust, visually stunning, and environmentally responsible. With approximately 245 professionals working across 7 countries and 7 specialized sectors, RKD serves complex global clients including Microsoft, Diageo, Equinix, MSD, and Yahoo, thriving where ambition meets complexity across sectors that shape economies and communities, from data centres to life sciences to education, healthcare and beyond. David Petterbridge is RKD's Managing Director. His practical economic sense and can-do attitude create buildings and spaces for clients that form the physical manifestation of their organisational vision. He uses design responsibly as a force for positive change, helping clients to successfully navigate challenges in their real estate portfolios. David, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Aidan. Pleasure.
I hope
to be
I got
here.
Everything there.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
So, RKD, over 100 years old. Tell me how the company has evolved over that period.
Well, the company, as you say, is over 100 years old, founded in the sort of the rubble of the Rising in 1916 when O'Connell Street was in bits, and a couple of entrepreneurial architects got together and said, oh, there's a gap here. Started designing replacement buildings for those which were destroyed. Mm-hmm. And that was the genesis of the practice.
Okay.
It started as Robinson Architects and then moved to Robinson Keefe. And then in the 1950s, 60s, it became Robinson Keefe and Devan, which then morphed over the years into RKD Architects. And now we're known as RKD.
Okay. And what's your history then within the company?
I have worked all my career in RKD.
Okay.
I came in straight from college as a student in placement following 4th year in college. Architects go to college for 5 to 6 years. In your last year, you pick a subject for a thesis. I decided I would like to do something in the healthcare field. My mother was a nurse, so had some interest in that. And at the time, way back then, it was the time where Tala Hospital was being designed, the biggest hospital in the state, and RKD, Robinson Keefe Devan, were the architects for it. So one of my lecturers at the time, the late Eamon Murphy, said to me, oh, you should go into Robinson Keefe and Devan, they're doing Tala. Have a word, ask for Roddy. It was a small place back then, Dublin. So I would start dialing up the phone every day. Hello, could I speak to Mr. McCaffrey? No, he's busy. Eventually, one of the younger partners picked up the phone and said, listen, would you mind stop ringing? Just come in next Monday. You're fine. Got in the door and never left. So I didn't do an interview, didn't do anything. Started as a student. It was the best thing for me. Gave me a huge amount of organisational skills. I worked on amazing projects like the Guinness Storehouse as a student way back then. Hewlett-Packard, colouring in elevations. My wife still thinks I colour in for my day job.
Yeah, you're lucky. My wife doesn't know what I do for a day job.
And just started at the bottom and worked my way up.
Hmm. I always wonder, when you have a company with that kind of 113-year legacy, right? How do you marry that with the need to evolve and develop and innovate in you know, like, there's obviously been huge developments over that period. So how do you manage to kind of keep that legacy but not let it be an anchor to you?
Absolutely. It's so important. Like, we don't live in the past.
Yeah.
We have to be agile. We have to be at the cutting edge of everything we do. It's a great story to tell. It gives us, as you say, legacy, pedigree, and it gives us some credence in the market. Mm-hmm. But the RKD, the Robinson Architects from the 1910s, is nowhere near where we are now in terms of RKD. It gives us something that we can talk about. Mm-hmm. What RKD specialises now in is big, complicated, complex projects. But if you go all the way back to 1910 or the 60s, we did complicated projects on O'Connell Street. In the 60s, we did amazing amount of industrial units for the IDA at the time, when there was a massive amount of inward investment coming in with the likes of the Kodak plant and the likes of that. They were complicated projects at the time. We've just notched up sort of generation after generation as to what we are now.
And does the complexity change, the level of complexity change, or is it just the end function that changes?
The complexity changes, technology changes, the speed of operation, the speed of design, the speed of production changes. The life cycle of buildings is so much quicker now. A building can be constructed, make its products for a period of 10 years and be defunct and needs to be totally recycled again. That's happening quicker and quicker every sort of generation of design.
Yeah. And then, you know, when you look back since your first day in there, what do you think have been the major changes in design and architecture over that period?
When I started in the mid 90s, we were still on drawing boards. We were still drawing with pen and ink and large T-squares, drawing things manually with ink, scratching out mistakes with razor blades. And it was a very laborious, slow process. Every drawing had to be very measured. Everything was very carefully done, and it took a long time. Then we started into computers and CAD and producing things that could be repeated and printed in multiple times, get in and edit things quickly. And then we've moved on from there again. That was a cycle through the noughties where AutoCAD was the main forum, and all of the other disciplines we shared drawings didn't really talk to each other, but you had drawings that kind of the builder had to make sense and put it all together. Now we live in a world of 3D cloned models of a real, so it's a miniature version of the whole building or project that's going to be developed. Everybody's working collaboratively in the cloud, putting their pieces in together. You can see if everything fits, if everything clashes, if anything has to be sorted. It's done before you get to site. That speeds up the process. It means we can do things more quickly. We can do things that are more complicated you could never do in two dimensions, never mind in pen and ink. But now you can spin models around, you can play around with it, and you can get the right answer. You can also call off an awful lot more data from that, which will tell you how the building will perform, its cost and use, its energy usage. Everything can be broken down into minor components. So data is really driving how we do our business now.
And then, you know, when you think about that, you know, and you look at the buildings that have been designed today, again, I think you kind of said it there, there's no way you could design the buildings today if you were still back in that, in that pen and ink, could you?
It would have taken a lot longer to do it for a start. But I think the level of sophistication that you see, you take a factory from the 70s, what was going in there was a production line, a machine that sat in a big shed. There's an awful lot more sophistication on process, the treatment of elements. Like, we do big microchip factories all over the world. There's a process before the chip comes to site. There's a process to treat the chip. There's a process to pack the chip. All of those have subsets of processes that come in and plug into this massive campus. It's levels up of sophistication and complexity that we wouldn't be able or capable of doing back then.
And then you have the whole overlay of sustainability and all of that to layer on top of that. So, you know, is it possible then now in the way buildings are designed that that stuff has been designed in from the start as opposed to kind of the after? I go, oh, actually, do you know what? We need to get this building sustainable or whatever it is.
It's really important that it starts at the very first genesis of every project. It has to be built into every thought you make, because every design decision that we take has an implication. As an implication for cost, it's an implication for program, it's an implication for how much carbon the building may use, how much reusable material we're going to put into this building. We do it in-house. We do it as it's an integral part of our design process. And we have a team that supports every project through the practice to make sure there's an overview on sustainability considerations. Other practices, other industries might take a different view. For us, it's so important that it starts on day one.
Okay. You know, we talked about the last 20. What do you think will be the next 20 then? And will the pace of change be quicker, do you think, in the next 20 than it was in the last 20?
I think so. I think it's inevitable that we are going to go faster. We're going to go bigger. You just have to look at the bigger picture on this planet. The amount of people that are here that need services, that need buildings, that need data. There's a demand to drive that. We have got better at automating, using artificial intelligence to take out some of the more standard procedures and processes to make that even quicker. But that will continue to evolve. Factories, buildings, they're all getting bigger. They're getting quicker. We need them quicker. We need them to meet demand.
And the, I presume then the need for accuracy is much higher than, like, you know, you just can't kind of draw it up and get to the site and go, oh, actually, do you know what? That won't fit there.
The huge benefit of basically a digital twin where you've built and designed everything virtually in the cloud before you get to site is you've ironed out a huge amount of those clashes and inconsistencies. Mm. The tolerances can be much finer. There's a massive amount of off-site production now. So where you might have had, for example, a bricklayer or a block layer laying a couple of hundred blocks a day, that's now made in a factory, put in the back of a truck, driven into site and clipped into place. So you can do multiples of that quicker. The important point of that is the tolerances have to be really tight and everything works together in that way. So that's why we do that with the Revit, the BIM models that we use to make sure everything is pieced together perfectly before it gets to site. That's
and then the theory anyway. Presumably then the whole end-to-end production of a building then, because you've got you guys design it, then it moves to QS, then ultimately to the build. Like, it's there's kind of can be an awful lot of stuff can be done in train in terms of the builder seeing the stuff long, you know, he's not waiting for the big piece of paper to come down and go, oh, there we go, right? They're seeing it before. The QS are seeing it. The end-to-end processing time must have significantly reduced over that period.
It's a far more collaborative process than it might have been before. You're quite right, where we used to draw everything to the nth degree, write specifications that were a couple of Bibles amount of paper, and then banker box it all over to six contractors who had to read it all and come back with a price.
Yeah.
Now, because of the way we work, you can actually bring in early contractor involvement. You can get their advice on buildability. The design team are involved all the way through the process. So it's no surprise to a quantity surveyor or cost controller to say, oh my God, had I known this wouldn't have cost this much. They're involved all the way through. Mm-hmm. Design team meetings, clients are more educated on what things should cost. So we avoid the dreaded value engineering at the other end.
Okay. And then how does it, you know, both where you have, you're trying to manage a project from you guys have multiple sites, so presumably, you know, how is the management of a project from multiple sites and then with maybe multiple different parties in multiple different sites?
It's very simple. We transformed our business in 2022. We were just coming out of COVID. Before that, we were a geographically based business. And what I mean by that is that we had offices in Dublin, we had offices in Cork, we had an office in Belgium, we had an office in Belfast. And if a project came in and it was near one of those offices, those people who worked in that office did that project. Mm-hmm. That didn't necessarily mean that person might have been the best suited person to work on that project. They may just have been near and handy and available. Mm-hmm. What we did in 2022, when we had a change in management, we transformed it. We've sectorized the business. So we have seven key sectors, and those people work in the sector that's best suited to them as a subject matter expert,
okay,
all the way down in vertical strands. It has also allowed us to exponentially grow the business and also to put people, to find skilled labour and skilled design professionals around the world to plug into our virtual models and draw them in that way. If you think back to 21, 22, we were coming out of COVID. There was a massive bump in demand because COVID had quelled the demand for development, for example. But then it came roaring back and clients needed this and needed it immediately. And there was a massive demand for our services. Ireland was struggling and is still struggling, to be honest, with the housing crisis, the cost of living crisis. In previous cycles where we might have been met with such demand, we could attract skilled labour to come to Ireland. That was not the case in 22. So we had to think quickly. I said, right, what will we do? We had a number of great people working with us in Ireland for many years, from Poland, from Spain, from other parts of the world. And we said, look, where can we find great educated architects, designers, engineers, and let's form an office in those locations. Ideally, it's an office location that has the prospect of work and projects in that location. But first and foremost, the initial thing was find really good people. From that, we started in Krakow, small beginnings with a couple of Polish guys who worked for us in Dublin. Similarly in Spain, we moved to Malaga, beautiful city. Most people come out of the airport in Malaga and turn right.
Yeah.
Nobody goes left and sees the city. It's an amazing place. We started there. And in time, then we also opened in Milan. We've more recently opened in London, and we are following our clients and developing that. That has led us to be able to meet the pent-up demand for our services and other services, and be able to sectorize the business. And once people are coming to a workplace and they're working in a sector, I like them to be there collaborating together. We don't do work from home in architecture. Nobody should. It's a collaborative studio-based environment. You need to be talking and listening to each other. Once you're coming to work in one of those locations and working on our projects, you're learning, you're listening, and you're growing the business with us.
And then as the managing partner, is it very difficult to manage multiple sites?
There's a bit of travel involved.
Right.
I sometimes feel like I'm the court jester going around from place to place to place, but that's important. People want to feel part of a larger organisation. Yeah. I tie it up with meetings with clients, with business development opportunities. We do an awful lot of work with Enterprise Ireland, who are fantastic at pushing the Irish companies out internationally. We're really great as a country at doing that. We have fantastic design skills and specialist skills that the world needs, and we go on that. So I'll try and do every month, 6 weeks, I'll be in one of those offices. I can work anywhere. I have laptop, will travel, and tie it up with other meetings.
And the specialisms into discrete sectors, seven discrete sectors, there's a kind of a pro to that, is that people then know you as those sectors and they'll come to you if they're in that sector, and they'll come to you. But the flip side of it is, there's lots of other buildings in other sectors that your expertise could easily be used in. And do you find then that people don't come to you to those because they're kind of, we know they're good in these seven, but we're not in those seven.
Well, maybe we don't want to do work in those sectors as well.
Okay.
For example, one of the clear and sort of very obvious submissions is residential work.
Mm.
There's a massive demand to design and build residential units, both in Ireland and elsewhere. But in my opinion, and this is part of our business strategy, there's many, many more competitors in that market. Mm-hmm. So if you've got lots, I'm not teaching economics to yourself, now, mm-hmm. but if you have a lot of supply of specialisms, the pricing will be lower, and it's a more competitive market. Mm-hmm. For us, we focus on the markets that have less competitors and are highly specialised, and we can export that because we're in demand on that basis. Mm-hmm. The sectors that we focus on most for export are data centres and high technology projects, life sciences and pharmaceuticals, and specialist high volume manufacturing product businesses like breweries and microchip, memory chip plants.
But there's a commonality between them in that they're very high tech, high spec, as opposed to high tech as well, but also high spec buildings typically.
Yes, and that's what we're good at.
Yeah.
That's the reputation that RKD has around the world now. We're seen as a global provider of these services on highly complicated projects. Mm-hmm. And we're not afraid also to support bigger organisations. We know some of the projects we work on could be 10, 20, 30 billion developments, campuses, massive campuses. We only need to take a small piece of that and support people.
One building out of the campus.
Absolutely. We're currently working on a project in Boise, Idaho. We're doing one building, which in itself is a 2 billion construction build, part of a 20 billion campus.
Yeah. I always wonder about this, and this is more a general question in terms of architects, but do you think, does a building reflect the owner or the architect that has created it?
It should, if it's a successful building, reflect both.
Okay.
The real trick in architecture is to be very convincing, to explain in both verbally and in visual terms why the building that you've designed is absolutely perfect, on brief, meets the budget, is designed around a process that's really, really important to that client. It shouldn't be an architect's
style
or whim. And if you look at RKD in particular, we don't have a house style. We never have. We design our buildings from first principle around what our client needs. They're always of top quality. They're always, I would like to consider, timeless. They're not a fad or a fashionable statement that people say, oh, that was designed in 2021. Yeah. Remember when everyone used lime green back then? No, yeah. That's not what we're about. We're about something that's perfectly fit for purpose, designed, meets the client's brief exactly.
So it's function over form.
Well, to a point. Yeah. But in the types of projects that we're involved in, function is so, so important. If it doesn't work, it's a disaster, as you can imagine.
What would you say is the culture in RKD?
The culture in RKD has evolved over the years because it's gone through multiple generations. But I'd like to think now our culture is about transparency, collaboration, development of our people, who are all fantastic. We need to be considering our succession planning at all times. At some point, somebody will knock on the door and say, I'm ready to take over. Fantastic. Mm. Then we've done our job. We want people to think of us as trusted advisors, people who know how to solve problems, complicated problems, with you together as part of a team, and have fun doing it as well. That's really, really important. We have a fantastic culture of celebrating together, summer parties, Christmas parties. It means having to go to quite a lot of Christmas parties around the world, but somebody has to wear that hat and do it. But I try my best to do it and then recover over Christmas. Mm. But it's fun. It's part of what we do. You want people to enjoy their work, and they want people to, and particularly in a tight labour market, tell them how good it is, so people may want to join us too.
And then on that basis, you know, it's the same for every service industry, but you're managing assets and they walk in and out the door every day, right?
Yes.
And you know, they're not machines, they're not anything, right? They're not, you know, they're ultimately human. So it's a very different skill set to manage those assets.
Yes, you have to make people feel they're on a pathway with you, particularly with the younger generation who are less loyal. The previous generations would go to a firm, a professional services firm, might stay their whole career, me as a good example. But now people are less loyal to employers. They're more about their personal development, their pathway on a journey that they're going on. Mm. So if we invest lots and lots of time, and a typical architect, when they've reached about 20 years of practicing, have reached the average experience level of an architect. Mm-hmm. It takes from a long education, third level education of 6 years, it takes conservatively 3 to 4 years before you've got that person really motoring well. Mm-hmm. You don't want to see them going out the door at that point. You've invested so much time. So we have to give them a vision on where they're going and where they will go in our practice. We reorganised our structures to give smaller jumps and smaller stepping stones. So, okay, I might be a graduate architect here. To get to architect level, I need to qualify. I need to get my chartership. Mm. Then I'm an architect. What does it take to get to be a senior architect? Maybe an associate, a senior associate, a design sector lead. So we put a lot of work into structuring the business to make that attainable for people and to give them directions of travel. Not only focusing, traditionally architects were qualified architects, and if you weren't a qualified architect, you were a technologist or a technician back in the old days, and you drew and you didn't really do very much else. But that was a very short-sighted view. People can contribute in so many different ways, and we broke down those boundaries to say anybody can be an owner or a partner in a practice, if you have the right attitude and you work your way towards
it. So you don't have
it.
To be an architect to be an owner or
a director of the company. No more. No, absolutely. It's about your skill, your
what you're bringing to the table.
What you're bringing. And we run RKD like a business now. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really important. Like, we should all run our businesses like businesses. Stereotypically, architects have not been renowned for being good business people as well. You would have heard lots of stories of fantastically avant-garde architects, but terrible. They made no money, had great fun, but did that. I like to try and keep the balance that we make money and we have fun doing what we do and we produce bloody good buildings.
And then from a HR standpoint, are you, by the sounds of it, you can tell me, though, but are you more of a hire talent or develop from within?
It's a bit of both when we're in a growth phase.
Right.
So we do develop from within. That's that's the best, because you know what you have, and you can nurture and you can develop career paths through ongoing development and feedback with them and listen to them as to where they want to go, and you can react to that and adjust course as necessary. But as we're in growth phase and we have more projects coming on stream, we do need to attract from outside. At the sort of medium and upper levels, to then build teams around these people. Mm. We do like to attract people with experience who can slot into one of our sectors reasonably seamlessly. We're not that complicated. We don't have thousands of processes that are really complicated. We are an architectural practice. We're straight line. We like to move in a straight line, and people like that about us. It doesn't take too long if you've come from another organisation to come into RKD and get to speed up to speed with us.
But the flip side of that, and again, when because you raised the point earlier on about can't work from home because it's a collaborative environment. I like asking this question because it's always good to get the insight. Is, you know, what happens when you hire that person from the outside and they turn out to be a very talented asshole? And like there's carnage. They are a magnificent architect.
Yeah.
But God almighty, the collateral damage that's caused in a collaborative environment is just way too much.
It's it is a very more common than you would imagine in the architectural industry
a few prima donnas.
lots of egos, and what we call them is the Black Polo Neck Brigade, but there's no Black Polo Necks in RKD. It's a little bit more labour intensive, but myself or one of my other fellow sort of executive directors always try and interview everybody that we can.
Okay.
Because we know our culture, we can spot. I can tell within 2 minutes of meeting somebody whether they're going to be a fish or not.
Yeah.
And that has hugely avoided the scenario of somebody coming in and being disruptive.
Yeah.
It doesn't totally avoid it, but we minimise it by spending the time carefully hiring.
Going back to the building design and things like that, do you think, can a corporate culture be manifested in the design of a building? So your company, can you design a building that reflects their corporate culture?
You can, absolutely. Yeah. It's about understanding your client's brief and needs. And we've worked with most of the big tier one international companies. Where, for example, out in Leopardstown, we did Microsoft's European headquarters a few years ago. That's a multi-headed beast with lots of things going on. They were in a couple of different buildings out there, all in little silos of developers and accounts and incoming, and like a lot of stuff going on. And they came to us and said, we want to bring everyone together.
Mm.
I said, great. Okay, well, I'm going to spend some time, and my team here are going to spend some time, and we're going to understand how you do your businesses, what is important to be where, who needs what type of space. And then we're going to wrap everything around a central space that will make it really, really collaborative and work together. And they went on that journey with us, and we're delighted with the results. It's been a fantastic development. That's only one example, but that can go for any type of organization. We did LinkedIn's first owner-occupied building, as you referenced at the start. Before, heretofore, they just took space. They rented space around the world. This was the first building that they designed with an architect and a team of design professionals from First Principles. And that worked brilliantly for them. They created the spaces that absolutely worked around their business flows, their processes, and their people and their culture.
Mm.
That was a remarkable success for them, and has really meant that they've anchored themselves in Dublin now, as you can see around Wilton Place, with more developments there.
And do you think clients don't often enough do that, in terms of they kind of find a building that they go, oh, look, it'll be all right. We can kind of shoehorn it a bit and then we'll get 80% of what we want and that's all right.
That can happen on occasion, and it's normally program driven, where somebody needs to be somewhere to meet a date, or they're coming out of a building and they didn't allow enough time to get out and find another option.
Yeah.
A good architect will work with a client, and we'll challenge a client in a polite way to say, I don't think this is quite right for you. What I've listened to and what I've heard, I think we collectively need this. But if there's constraints and we need to move in this way, we will make the best of this possible and we'll do a fantastic job.
Okay. There's often this idea of with success comes the risk of distraction. Right? And we were talking about the seven verticals and things like that. But as you get bigger and things like that, and again, there's an awful lot of commonality between the sectors that you've got in terms of high spec and things like that. How do you continue to evolve and push that, but not end up going down a rabbit hole that you're going, what the hell are we doing designing? Now, you never go to design houses, right? But, you know, there could be other areas that you just, you know, you shouldn't probably go into.
You're absolutely right. And I think the structure that we've put in place when we reorganized our business took some of the day-to-day activities away from people who needed to retain a strategic overview. I'm 90% strategy in terms of oversight of the business, watching people from different sections coming in and reporting to me and others on what they're doing and how they're doing. So I'm looking at the high level. I'm not getting into the nitty-gritty detail. That means that we can see trends and we can respond to it. And I'm not stuck in project meetings talking about drip details and window facade costs and the like. I love doing that. I'd love to do that all the time, but that's not...
I was going to ask you, could you go back to the shop floor?
I could. I possibly can't draw in 3D the way that these guys are brilliantly at it, but I can manage a project like nobody else.
Yeah.
And I do occasionally, some clients still, believe it or not, still would like me to sit in a couple of meetings and just steer things. I'm very careful not to get too heavily involved, not for any other reason that other than I want the people who are working on the project to feel empowered to make their own decisions.
Yeah, and they need to have the relationship with the client.
Yes. Mm-hmm. My door is, we recently moved offices and we're over in the Liberties over in Newmarket Square. And that gave us an opportunity to bring three offices together in one. I am technically in an office, but I may as well not have a door because the door is always open. I like to be in the office if I'm in Dublin 5 days a week. People are coming and going and it's the best feeling in the world for people to share things, particularly problems. Problems are things that can be shared through experience and solved through experience. And I love that. And I had that experience when I was in an earlier stage of my career in Orcadia that I could go to a partner and say, this has gone wrong. How are we going to fix it? Mm. There's nothing hidden under the carpet. It's about trying to be as open and we come together. We don't leave somebody hanging out. We collectively support each other to get the job done by whatever we need to do.
Customers are great at telling you what's wrong with something, but not necessarily telling you what the solution is to that. And you could argue, well, it's not their job to find the solution. It's your job to find the solution. So how do you tease out and marry up what's wrong and where the right solution? Because there could be multiple solutions to the problem.
Yeah, design is a very subjective subject. There is no right or wrong. It's not black and white. Yes, you might have performance criteria that a building must operate at a certain temperature. It must be this high for clearance and this and that. They're facts and we design. Obviously, that's straightforward. But there are multiple ways to solve anything. And it's trying to find the best balance. Some clients know what works and they absolutely know that. But they also know there's probably a better way as well. And our job as an architect or an experienced part of a team is to listen very carefully, to tease out what's working well, also to prod in particular directions as what's not working. Why aren't you getting X amount of product through in a particular way? Oh, well, because we changed this and we did that. And if this building was 20 metres longer, we could have got this version of this production line and that would have been far more efficient. Okay, that's really good to know. We'll factor that in. Often as well, you might say, well, okay, we're designing for a current process. But what are we thinking about for the expansion? Let's say this is a blazing success and we want to expand. Have we thought together how we might do that so it doesn't affect the process or we're squeezing the second bit into something that's not going to be big enough to get the same efficiencies out of this really efficient phase one? So you're looking ahead. And for example, we're doing the new brewery for Guinness out in Kildare at the moment. Phase one is on site. And we're already now in the design process for phase two because it has been a blazing success. The Guinness 00, the Guinness production, and other lagers and things like that are all taking off like wildfire across Europe. The James's Gate Brewery is going to focus on Guinness, but that they needed more capacity. And we looked at that. We looked at sites with them. We found a site that had plenty of expansion potential. And then we planned for phase one, and then where would phase two, three, etc., go on going from there?
But can you future-proof a building from technological change as opposed to volume change?
There is a balance to be struck because if you future-proof to the nth degree, it's going to be extremely expensive, and that you can only see so far with a crystal ball as to what's coming.
Yeah.
So you might say, right, okay, what's in your pipeline? Where are you going with the development research and development on your whatever you do? And let's try and build some of that in. But if you build in for 20 years, sure, the buildings are changing so quickly, that could be redundant and it could be an absolute waste of a valuable asset.
Yeah. What do you think is the hardest job as managing partner?
Oh, the hardest job is probably trying to keep everybody happy. I've said that we have a great collaborative environment, but there are always people who need to be managed and need to be encouraged. And there's also sometimes performance issues, thankfully very few in RKD, but you need to deal with that and you need to be tough and fair, because if you're not, people will say, oh, hold on a second, I'm playing by the rules. This person isn't. So that's, I like to think I'm a reasonably nice person, I'm friendly, and I've come up through the ranks of RKD, so I understand where we have been on that journey together. But you do also have to be firm and fair at some points. Don't like it, but that's something that comes with the territory.
And when you look at the RKD story, you know, what gets more credit for its success, luck or hard work, do you think?
It's both.
Is it?
It is both. I was very, very lucky. Very lucky. And the project, once I came back after college, they invited me back and said, if you want a job, there's a job here for you. And I went back in. I got to work on the expansion of Galway, University Hospital in Galway. The project had been won. I went in as a graduate architect and was working on a team of maybe 7 or 8 people at the time. A couple of architects, a couple of technologists, myself as a graduate, and there was a partner in charge. Over the course of the first 6 or so months, gradually the people in the middle all moved off. It was a busy time in Ireland and got different jobs, and I was there working away. And before long, there was a partner, there was a technologist, and there was myself on the job. And the partner goes, how did that happen? Because, like, as you know, and I said, well, I've just been doing it all. Yeah. He says, you're a graduate. I said, yeah. And I'm very happy to continue doing it. But, oh, no, we'll have to get more people. So give me a chance. I think I can do this. And I did. And it was just luck. I was in the right point, the right time, and an opportunity, and you just grab it. You know, that was my view at the time, and I did.
And when you look at the strategy for the growth strategy for RKD going forward, is it going to be much more organic or organic and acquired?
We're looking at, without taking giving you any trade secrets, which I'm sure you wouldn't expect too much of.
No, definitely not.
It's a bit of both. We will grow organically. We will continue to do what we do with analysing our pipelines, looking at what's coming and planning in that way. But it's a very dynamic time in our industry where there's an awful lot of acquisitions going on around us. If we stand still and we only grow organically, I can see us being lapped and overtaken. And although we might be growing, we're growing at less of a rate than others who are growing by acquisition. So we're always on the lookout for that. We're also no fools. We consider that perhaps at some point we might become an attractive acquisition for somebody else. So be it. If that works for us and the timing is right, we'd consider that as well. But at the moment, we're only three and a bit years into our current company structure. We're ploughing ahead and making hay.
And then what's the approach to change?
Change has to be embraced. If you need to be thinking both change in terms of people, of management, that has to be first and foremost in your mind as to how will we continue to adapt and change. That's by bringing people up from below to ultimately replace us, but also to grow out the sectors, to put more leaders in place. Change also is possible through stopping one of those sectors, saying that makes no sense anymore. If something is, there's a phrase that you can be a busy fool and make no money.
Yeah.
Be very busy going to work every day and at the end of the day, make no profit. What's the point of doing that? So we very carefully analyse, and this is something that most practices should do more of. We look at the incoming fees, we look against the cost of our people and the cost of doing that particular line of business. Does it make sense? Is there enough of a margin? If there isn't enough of a margin, we'll try and adjust that. We'll figure out why it's not working for us. If that continues not to work, we might just stop doing that type of work. And that's one of the reasons we just said with residential work, we don't want to do that. It's too labour intensive and it's not rewarding enough.
And then, you know, when you look at it and you look at driving that business forward, is fear of failure a driving force for you?
It has to be.
Okay.
It has to be. If you take no risks, you're not going to grow. You're not going to be able to seize an opportunity that comes. So we are speculative. We have a great team of people who can root out opportunities, who can mind clients really carefully. 75-80% of our work is repeat business, which is a fantastic. That's the best business you can ever win, is the one where the client comes back with another project and another project, because we like to think we're doing a very good job for them. But if you become complacent, you will make mistakes. Mm. If you make mistakes, one, you might get sued and your reputation may go down. If your reputation gets damaged, you're dead in some of the sectors we're in, if you've made a mistake. So you have to be on edge and be always looking and using the experience. And that's why we have many of us in strategic overview roles in the business, looking and watching and just trying to catch anything that might be a problem, and change course to adjust.
And how, in kind of in a similar vein, how do you feel, or do you feel innately responsible for maintaining the legacy of RKD in the same way?
I think so. It's a big responsibility. We have a lot of mouths to feed, and we have a lot of people who...
But you have a lot of history too, that you you don't want to be the one that destroyed 113 years of history.
Absolutely. And I would not intend on anything like that ever happening. We are resilient. We look at ways, like the previous RKD may have been heavily, heavily dependent on the Irish construction market. Mm. Irish construction market goes up and down, peaks and troughs, and it's highly cyclical. That was one of the reasons why we diversified. We wanted to get out, flatten that curve, and not be the practice that got caught out, where they had too much exposure to speculative developments. The bills just stopped getting paid and you've got a big workforce. We work for international companies who pay us on the dot every month an agreed amount for an agreed service. Mm. That's, and I can't be complacent about that, but that model really works for us. And it means that we can be very careful with our business decisions, but we can rely on the business decisions we take. There is, just look at 2025, which for us was quite a flat year after 3 years of really, really good growth. Mm-hmm. But flat, in my mind, was actually very good last year. We did the same numbers as we did in 2024, more or less, in the context of all of the uncertainty around tariffs, which continent you're going to make a product in, and what is the impact of that. A lot of our big clients were kind of at sea for the first 6 months, didn't know what to do, all hit the pause button at the same time. We collectively said, this is only temporary. Now, we were reviewing that regularly and every month, as you will, but we said, this is only temporary. We'll monitor it, but we're going to retain all of our key people. Mm. We're going to make sure we have that for when it comes back, we're in a position to roar back. And that is happening now in 2026. We can see that already.
Yeah, stuff was deferred as opposed to binned. And the worst thing would have been, it suddenly kicks back up and you don't have the staff because you said, oh, it's a short-term decision. You know, we just can't make the numbers work.
For the scale of projects we work on, we always have to carry a capacity to instantly respond. Because if you can't say yes to that client every time,
they'll
go elsewhere and they'll take, and you may have lose that client. Yeah. So you have to be able to say, absolutely, yeah, we'll put Mary and Joe on that tomorrow. Mm. That's part of our business strategy and we carry that as a business cost.
Mm-hmm. What personal characteristics do you think are most important as the managing partner?
Well, I think it's personal characteristics as David Petteridge, not only the managing partner, is somebody who understands people, who is fair, is not a scary person that you can't come up to and ask any question. And I say to people all the time, ask me as many questions as you want. Just don't ask me the same question twice.
Yeah.
And I say that even when we interview people, and if I'm doing an interview, I will ask people, and what was the biggest mistake they've made so far in their career? If somebody says, I haven't made any, I nearly end the interview then.
And what was your biggest mistake?
Oh. I won't go into the technical detail, but it was a very, very subtle dash missing from a specification that resulted in the performance of a particular component on a particular project not meeting the span. And it was an innocuous little dash. And I didn't understand, as a much more junior architect, the significance of that dash. Never, ever have RKD or myself made that mistake again. And we are very, very hot on that particular topic. Mm-hmm. But if I love nothing better than, and I catch people on the hop in an interview process and they go, oh, and then they're not sure whether they should admit it or they should, is this a sign of weakness? Look, I've made lots of mistakes in my career. I'd love to know what ones you've made. Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, well, I did this, this and this. I said, great. And then I say, well, that's perfect. You'll never do it again. Oh, I would never do that again. that's a sign of humility as well, which is important.
And also personal development.
Absolutely.
You know. What advice would you give to young people?
In what
career
context?
Advice, life advice, take whatever you like.
Well, I do an awful lot of work with some secondary schools, and I grew up on the north side of Dublin. I went to a Christian Brothers school. I went to Ard School Rish on Griffith Avenue in Marino. It wasn't a fee-paying school. It was salt of the earth. Mm-hmm. And it moulded me. And I knew very quickly what I wanted to be because I loved technical drawing. There was a Mr. Cleary in there who was one of the most wonderful teachers. That was where I was going. But in the years since then, I've always gone back and I've always given back to the school, either through TY programmes and brought students in to experience architecture or to go back and give a talk or go to a careers night. And there was a careers night only last week where I went in for a couple of hours and I sat at a desk with a little architecture sign above my head. But a lot of the boys, it's a boys' school, came over and they just wanted to chat. How did you do? What did you do this? And I said, guys, if I was to do it all again, I'd work harder in college at the start, because a lot of people, particularly, and I was very, very young. I had just turned 17 when I walked in the door at Bolton Street back in 1992. I was the oldest of my family, so I was the first to go to college. So I didn't have anyone to follow to understand the rules and that. Mm-hmm. Had I known, I probably worked a little bit harder to focus on getting as good a grade as possible. I know for my own children now, one of whom is in college, it's a very, very competitive environment now. And you need to go through with the same level of effort as on day one as you go through as day two, as the final day when you walk out with your bit of paper. I also tell people to pick something they'll enjoy.
Yeah.
Don't pick something because you think you're going to make a lot of money out of it. It's beneficial if you do, of course, and you have a comfortable life. But you're going to do something perhaps for 10, 20, 40 years. You want to get out of bed every day and enjoy getting out of bed and not fearing it and going, oh my God. Like,
yeah, the dread.
The dread. And I tell people to work a lot of little jobs when they're starting out, part-time jobs when you're in school, when you're in college. I worked as a barman. I did letter sorting for On Post at Christmas. If you wanted a boring job, there's one back then. I had to make a game of it. Mm-hmm. But you appreciated it. But you also appreciated the value of effort and how much money you were getting for that type of effort back then. It makes you more aware of the importance of working hard and the value of effort, which I think is really, really important.
Then who do you seek advice from?
I seek advice from my fellow directors. Right. We're together. We're five of us. We meet at least once a week, although we huddle together multiple times over the course of the day because we all like to be in the office. We seek counsel from each other. I have a good contact base of industry friends and connections who I can bounce off, and they like to bounce things off me. I have an unbelievable amount of secrets which are kept in here, which people will ask me their opinion of something in confidence, and it stays fully in confidence, but it might be a big career decision that person might be wanting to take. And I like to think I can ask those people in confidence that type of thing too. I ask my wife a lot of the time what her view would be of things. She's a wonderful person and has a huge amount of life experience as well. And that has been great counsel to me. My father is now retired, but he was a salesman all his career. He sold stainless steel in Ireland. He imported stainless steel and sold it on as a commodity to all the fabricating plants in Ireland. He gave me a huge amount of aptitude for sales. Mm-hmm. And that's something, I suppose, in the architecture game, we're still selling. We're selling all the time. We're always, without it, if you cannot sell your idea, your concept, make eye contact, have an opinion, build a relationship, take someone out for a drink or a meal, that's sales. I watched my dad do that. And back when he was at his peak and I was in college, he used to bring me on trips where he might go to Holland or Spain. And instead of my mum going, he'd say, do you want to come? Mm. And I'd stay in the hotel. He'd go do his business and I'd wander around, have a look at the city. But I'd go to dinner with them and I'd see him operating. That kind of sticks in there, and it's ingrained in you.
There is
the
a bit. Time. There is a bit of a kind of a failure of an awful lot of professional services. They think they don't have to sell, like, because you know they think, oh well, you know, I'm such and such. Everybody needs my service.
The work
and therefore,
will just come to me. Yeah,
just come to me.
Doesn't work that way.
No.
That's the business that will shrink and eventually fade away.
Yeah.
We instill in all of our leaders From associate up, we've job descriptions, and part of it is selling. And I go, selling? I said, yeah, you're selling all the time. If you meet somebody and you're saying, I'm the best ever for sitting on a plane and just talking to somebody. You know very quickly if they put the headphones in, they don't want to talk back. Sometimes people do, and you just get a conversation going. And I've had remarkable discussions with people just
on
ad hoc ones, but found like, oh, do you know such and such? And we as Irish people are incredibly good at forming connections and finding a commonality. That's the gift of the gab, and the way you can just have a chat with someone and find an opportunity. It might be an opportunity for you. It might be an opportunity for a colleague or a friend or something like that. I know Joe in this company. I must put the two of you together. I'd like to think other people would do that for me in the same way. Mm. That's how a network should work.
Mm. Do you hate losing or love winning?
Oh, I hate losing.
Do you?
Absolutely. Albeit, the best project we lost was the Children's Hospital. Okay. We came second or third in that competition. And in hindsight, that was the best project we
ever
lost.
That's the Gareth Brooks.
It was back in 2012. The country was coming out of the 2008-2009 recession. Projects were starting to come to life. NAMA was releasing sites. There was an awful lot of commercial activity just starting to happen. And we didn't win the Children's Hospital. And we picked up a lot of commercial work, which drove the practice in a different direction. Mm-hmm. So that was a blessing in disguise. We love winning. We celebrate winning. But we have to make sure we're winning on the right basis. That the formation of our bids is right. We've put the right amount of time, the right people on the project. We have the right margin. And it's for the right type of client. We won't work for speculative clients. We work for clients who respect payment terms and are good to deal with as well. Because I have to protect our staff. Like, I'm not going to put somebody into an environment which is toxic. Mm. They might pay you a little bit more, but if they're not good people to work with, that's, as an employer, I have a duty to make sure we protect our staff.
Because I say it so many times, like, it's what's forgotten, I think, an awful lot of times, is people do business with people, right? And that's what it is. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're selling a widget or selling a service. People do business with people. And it's that interaction that you'll get on.
That's what I say to everybody. Form a bond, a commonality with your client. The first 2 or 3 minutes should be not about the project. Mm. You don't go into a meeting and just say, right, let's straight down to business. Yeah. Well, Aidan, how did you get on at the weekend? Were you at the match? Mm. What was such? How was your son getting on in college? That's normal. That's perfectly the way you should behave. And surprisingly, we have a lot of people who are not comfortable in that environment. We'll help them if they want help. And some people don't. Some people don't want to go there. Yeah. They just want to focus on the technical stuff, and they're technical geniuses, and we'll let them off. They're amazing at that. But there's other people who are good at it and just would like to get a little bit better. We'll encourage, we'll nurture, we'll develop, we'll train for them to become. And I'd like to think myself and others in the practice lead by example. And you observe that. Mm. And in an office where we're all collectively working together, it's so important. That's why you need to be in the office, observing what David is doing, what Ronan is doing, what Jer is doing. They're all people, leaders in our practice, and we lead by example, and we hope they follow.
Yeah. Fast or slow decision making?
Fast.
And on that basis, are you data-based or gut feel when you're decision making?
Experience-based. Okay. It would be a lot of my decision-making process. I'd like to think collectively. The availability of people to make those decisions is really important. That's why we're around all the time. And that's why it's like, right, we got to make a call on where we're going to buy our insurance this year from. We've got 3 options. Okay, well, let's go with these guys. We might have 2 options on, or 2 opportunities that both have equal importance. We need to pick one over the other. Let's go with that one because. Mm-hmm. And that might be just a gut feel. It might be just I read something in the Sunday Business Post over the weekend and go, I think that company might grow a little bit quicker than that one. That's a better opportunity. Let's put our eggs in that basket. Mm-hmm. We'd like to spread and do both.
Yeah.
But sometimes you have to make a call to say, let's go that way.
And then finally, how do you deal with setbacks?
Setbacks happen all the time. Problems happen in the architectural industry all the time. You break it down into component parts. You figure out why it has happened. You try and see if you can resolve it, first and foremost. A setback isn't always final.
Yeah.
It might just be something has gone wrong. You'll talk to the client, you'll understand how they're feeling, and then you'll try and put in place a plan to correct whatever may have happened and move forward again. Mm-hmm. Again, it's in our business, it's relationship-based. That client we have a setback, we try and figure out what's happened so that they will remain a client and come back to us time and time again.
Right. The black book question.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Let's see what we
have. Are
you
going to tell me who wrote this, or is this anonymous?
I know who wrote it. I can't tell you who wrote it. All right. It's kind of simple one, but it'd be interesting. Why do you do what you do?
Because I love what I do. I love every day getting out of bed. My day is different every single day. I love talking to clients. I love talking to staff. I love meeting strangers and having conversations about things that matter. And I love helping people as well. And being busy is so great because the day flies by and you feel like you've got an awful lot done.
That's fair enough. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd like to thank my guest, David Betteridge. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.